Get ready to rock radio, music you want to hear.
Do you think readers generally will emerge with a better understanding of Steve Hogarth or the band in general after reading these diaries, Steve?
I think certain readers will. I think a lot of the hardcore Marillion fans probably know me about as well as an audience ever knows an artist already, because I am the kind of artist who kind of wears his heart on his sleeve, not only in his writing, but in the way he would speak to an audience in a show. I try to give the audience me the way I am, rather than to pretend to be a star or something that I don't feel I am. And I suppose that has emerged over the years. I think when you're young and you're desperate to get somewhere, you tend to be more pretentious. And as you get older, you know, at some point you think, well, I should be myself. You know, it's obviously myself or some aspect of myself or the greater part of myself that is the artist that I am, and that's what people are coming to see, and that's why they're buying the tickets, and that's why they're buying the records. So let's not try and hoodwink them into selling them some sort of fake. Let's give them what I am. So I think the people who really are into Marillion, and we do have a very hardcore fan base, almost like a global family, really, they know what I'm about by now, I think. There may still, however, be insights into my life. I mean, I've had a few people write already who've read the book now, and have said that they thought, you know, there were some moments of sadness and loneliness in it that they weren't expecting. You know, perhaps they'd never realised how lonely you can get as a performer touring the world.
I mean, diaries can be very much kiss and tell, and sometimes a little bit bitter and twisted, to be honest, Steve. But have you avoided being controversial?
I never wrote it down in the first place. The kind of kiss, tell, sex, drugs, rock and roll aspect of, you know, the stereotype. I mean, I've had the odd moment or two over the years on all of those fronts. but I didn't feel the need to write it down. Why would you want to write something like that down? You know, what's the point of that? Is it to try and impress someone? Is it to try and outrage someone? Ultimately, it can become a kind of a betrayal, and it'll boil down to making people feel uncomfortable or hurt. And so I never set about writing these diaries with that in mind. And so I've kept certain things to myself. I also think that bitterness never looks good in print from anyone, you know, whether or not it's justified. There's nothing worse than reading someone being bitter about someone else. I think it always reflects much worse on the writer than it does on the subject. And so there was, I mean, only really one moment I can think of that had been written down in the diary that was quite bitter, and that was towards a chap called Mike Rossiter, who made the BBC documentary about the raising of the Bluebird and the quest to find the Bluebird in Coniston and to find Donald Campbell. And he made an entire documentary without mentioning the song Out of This World, which was the Marillion song that had taken Bill Smith to Coniston to begin his search for the Bluebird and his search for Donald. And Bill has always said to me, well, I told him, I always made it quite clear that was the reason, you know, that was the catalyst that took me to Coniston to begin searching for the Bluebird. And for whatever reason, he chose not to mention that at all in his documentary, and I thought that was really shoddy, personally, to leave something so fundamental out, you know, the reason they were all there. But he'd obviously decided, for whatever reason, that it shouldn't be mentioned, and I thought that was disingenuous. But I didn't want to start bad-mouthing him in print.
No. I mean, I think we should say, you've already mentioned it, really. I mean, it's, at least from the first 50 pages, Steve, it's a gentle trawl, really, through your history, and it's fascinating for that. And you were talking about loneliness and maybe surprising one or two readers. It's like a travelogue, actually. There's a lot of waiting around, as you might expect, a lot of coffee drinking, a lot of sniffling, actually. You seem to be catching quite a few colds, you know. Oh, and the most important thing is the brushing up of leaves.
The brushing up of leaves?
Yeah, round the house. That's all in there.
Yeah, well, you know, I just wrote down what had happened during the day, you know.
You're a normal guy, Steve.
It was. Well, yeah.
We can all relate to it, can't we? People will relate to this. It's great.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I was trying. The other thing that came across to me going back through those diaries from way back then was just how little I was at home. You know, I'd be in Mexico City one day, and then I'd be home for a day. And as you say, I'd brush up a few leaves and maybe feed the ducks on the pond with my little girl, and the day after I'd be in Poland again, you know, and 3 days after that I'd be in Rome, and then I'd be home for a day or two, and then I'd be in America. So the amount of travel and how little I was around back then, it was a very intense time. It's not so bad these days, you know, we still tour a lot, but we try and limit the touring to little bursts, and then, you know, and then have a few weeks at home.
Yes, I think the difference really is that you're more your own people now, aren't you? I mean, this period, in the early 1990s, you were beholden a little bit to EMI, weren't you? And it's like the last vestiges of the golden age of the record industry, really, where there were budgets, you were staying in decent hotels. I mean, I'm not saying you don't stay in decent hotels now, Steve, but, you know, it was different, wasn't it, in that period?
Well, they used to run us ragged. We weren't quite so in control of our own destinies. We had management, we had the major record label, and they would run you completely ragged once you'd made the record. The promotion used to be pretty hectic, and then, you know, the touring was hectic, and in between the promotion and the touring, then they'd be, well, can you just go to Mexico and make a video, and can you go to Iceland and make a video, and then can you be in London tomorrow night to change this audio track at Abbey Road, and then can you go across town and edit, you know, sit in on the edit of this video, and then when you finished, can you go to Radio 1 and sit in on Bob Harris's show for 2 hours till 2 a.m. and then can you go home and can you be up early because you've got to be at Heathrow? And it was a bit like that. I mean, there were times when, I mean, there's a day in there where I think I start the day somewhere like Rotterdam, and I fly to England to do a TV show in Southampton, and then fly to Paris for a gig that night. And we wouldn't do anything quite as mental as that anymore. You know, I think one country per day is enough, not three.
Yes. Yeah. Now, the diaries. So far, Fish appears quite gracious. I'm only talking about the first 50 pages. But, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the diaries don't cover what we might call the critical first couple of years when you were bedding into the band Marillion. Maybe that's a book to be written, Steve.
Well, you know, there's the possibility of memoirs, you know, rather than a diary. But I guess the sooner I write that, the better, because with each passing year, it gets hazier. But I've never really spent that much time around Fish. I think I've bumped into him definitely less than half a dozen times since I joined the band. And we've always got on. He's always been very nice to me when we've been together. I've occasionally heard things through the grapevine that have been said, you know, in interviews and things that might have been less than generous. But I don't even know if they're true things, because I don't bother with any of it. So you've got to take people as you find them. And he's always been very nice to me, and I've always been very nice to him. We've always got on. So we haven't really met that often, you know, as I say, probably less than half a dozen times.
Yes. Now, when you revisited your notebooks then for the book, The Invisible Man, did you have to embellish at all, or did they just appear as is? I mean, did you think they might have benefited from maybe a separate commentary on events to put it in context?
They're pretty much as is. There is a very, very small element of separate commentary where I will just occasionally, and only occasionally, I'll throw some brackets in there, and I'll just from the benefit of doubt, I'll go, it's 2014 and this did actually happen, you know. Or when I say certain people had made certain promises, I'll sometimes put in brackets, well, that never happened either, you know. So with the benefit of looking back, I can sometimes see that promises weren't kept or things that were planned never happened. And I sometimes mention that. I remember Tony Smith, the manager of Genesis, promising us that he kind of implicitly promised us that we could open for Genesis in America when he began to manage us. What he did was he basically came along to John Arneson, our manager, and incorporated John into Hit and Run, the Genesis management company. So we felt like he'd kind of nicked our manager and those with him, but we thought it was a risk worth taking because he made certain promises to us. First of all, he said he would get us an American record label by just picking up the phone. That never happened. And he, you know, also implicitly promised us we may well open for Genesis in America, which would have been a huge career boost for us at the time, because Genesis were absolutely huge at that point. I mean, they're still pretty huge now. If they toured tomorrow, I dare say they'd do well. But back then, they were the thing, and we compromised a little bit, you know, as those carrots were dangled, and of course, they never came to anything. So I've probably mentioned that here and there. But yes. I'm not bitter.